The Life of Jonathan Edwards, Tape 8, Continuation of a Letter to Mr. Hollis. It is on many other accounts of great importance that they should be brought to know the English language. This would greatly tend to forward their instruction, their own barbarous languages being exceedingly barren and very unfit to express moral and divine things. It would likewise open their minds, and by means of their acquaintedness and conversation with English, would tend to advance them in knowledge and civilization. Some pains has been taken to teach the children the English tongue, but nothing very considerable has been accomplished. And I can think of but two ways in which it can be effected, either by introducing a number of English children into the schools to learn with them and be their mates, or by distributing the Indian children into English families to live there a year or two, where they must be allowed to speak the English and nothing else, and then return into the Indian schools to perfect them in reading and writing and the knowledge of the principles of religion and all other useful knowledge. The latter, if their parents can be persuaded to consent to it, as probably they may, will be much the most effectual. I would therefore, sir, humbly propose that some such method should be taken with regard to the children who have the benefit of your liberality, and that part of your benefaction should be expended in this way under the care of prudent and faithful trustees, for in order to the business being managed thoroughly in future, a great deal of care and activity will be necessary, vastly more than the schoolmaster can have leisure for. There are many things pertaining to the regulation of the affairs of the instruction of the Indian children which seem greatly to require the care of a number of parents who shall be entrusted to dispose things according to the best of their discretion, sending from time to time a particular exact account of the manner in which they have laid out your money. I thought myself obliged to give you these intimations, you being at a great distance and not capable of knowing the exact state of things any otherwise than by the information of those who are on the spot, and it being fit that you should know those circumstances which are so important to the affair, that without a proper regard to them the great expense which you incur is liable to be in a great measure in vain. I humbly request your prayers to the fountain of all light and grace for his guidance and assistance in this important service which I have lately undertaken in this place. I am honored, sir, your most humble servant and affectionate brother in the gospel ministry, Jonathan Edwards. I'm moving forward now in the life of Jonathan Edwards to his treatise on the freedom of the will and information regarding it. The proposals for publishing the essay on the freedom of the will were issued in Massachusetts in 1753, but in consequence of the kind offer of Mr. Erskine and Mr. McLaurin to circulate the papers and procure subscribers for it in Scotland, the printing was postponed until the success of their efforts was known. What that success was probably cannot now be ascertained. The work was published early in the year 1754 under the title of A Careful and Strict Inquiry into the Modern Prevailing Notions of that Freedom of the Will, which is supposed to be essential to moral agency, virtue and vice, reward and punishment, praise and blame. This work is justly considered as the most labored and important of the metaphysical investigations undertaken by the author. The subject, as will be obvious from the preceding title, lies at the very foundation of all religion and of all morality. That it was also a subject of no ordinary difficulty appears generally to have been felt and in effect acknowledged, for until the time of Mr. Edwards it had never been thoroughly investigated either by philosophers or theologians, though it was constantly recurring in their reasonings on the great principles connected with the moral government of God and the character of man. John Calvin, in his chapter on the slavery of the will, may be taken as an example of the most that had been done to settle the opinions of the Orthodox and refute their opposers on the subject before this period. His defect in that of his followers until the time of Mr. Edwards is seen in this one thing, that they insisted on the great fact merely that the will of man was not in a state of indifference, but so strongly fixed in his choice as to require supernatural grace for conversion, overlooking in a great measure the nature of moral agency and what essential to its nature. Their opposers, on the contrary, were constantly affirming that freedom of will was necessary to moral agency, and carried their views to the extent that the will determined itself and could not be enslaved. In the state of ethical and theological science, Mr. Edwards set himself to the task of examining the great subject of moral agency as connected with the human will, and by the precision of his definitions and statements, the cogency of his reasonings, the fullness of his illustrations, the the thorough handling of all objections and the application of his views to many scriptural truths, he placed the grand points of his subject in a light so overwhelmingly convincing as to leave little room for any doubt or dispute afterwards. In this treatise, it is contended that the power of choosing or willing does itself constitute freedom of agency, and that particular acts of will are determined, i.e., are rendered certain, or become such as they are, rather than otherwise, by some sufficient cause or reason, in perfect consistency with their being acts of will, or in perfect consistency with that power of willing which constitutes freedom of agency. On the grounds that the power of willing pertains to man, the author asserts a natural ability, which is just occasion of precept, invitation, and so on, or of the will of God being addressed to him, and on the ground that his acts of will are rendered certain by a sufficient cause, the author asserts a moral inability. The principal point contended for, and which is most essential to the defense of the Calvinistic scheme of faith, in distinction from the Arminian, is the latter one, that the acts of the will are rendered certain by some other cause than the mere power of willing. What the particular cause or causes may be is not particularly considered, but this question is dismissed with a few brief remarks. The fact that there is and must be some such cause is the great subject argued and most powerfully demonstrated. This cause, he asserts, is the foundation of necessity, in the sense merely of certainty of action, and does not therefore destroy natural ability or the power of choice, nor imply that man acts otherwise than electively or by choice, so that it is a necessity consistent with accountability, demerit, or the contrary, and so with rewards and punishments. He asserts that all such terms as must, cannot, impossible, unable, irresistible, unavoidable, invincible, and so on, when applied here, are not applied in their proper signification, and are either used nonsensically and with perfect insignificance, or in a sense quite diverse from their proper and original meaning, and their use in common speech, and that such a necessity as attends the acts of men's wills is more properly called certainty than necessity. Rightly to understand this controversy, it must be observed that he and his opponents alike considered sin to consist in acts of will. Had this not been the case, it would have been idle for Mr. Edwards to have confined himself and his whole treatise to acts of choice and the manner in which they are determined, i.e., rendered certain. He must in that case have agitated the previous question respecting acts of choices themselves, and have asserted and maintained that something else of specifically a different nature enters into moral character and forms a ground of praise and blame or retribution. But the question which he considered to be at issue is this: does the mind will in any given manner without a motive, cause, or ground which renders the given choice rather than a different choice certain? Whitby, the writer whom he especially has in view in his remarks on the freedom of man, asserts that man by his own activity alone decides the choice. Mr. Edwards acknowledges that man chooses, but asserts in opposition to the opinion of Whitby and those who side with him that there must be some other ground or cause besides the mere activity of man or his power of choosing which occasions his choosing in one manner rather than another. He asserts that doubtless common sense requires men's being the author of their own acts of will in order to their being esteemed worthy of praise or dispraise on account of them. The very act of volition itself is doubtless a determination, i.e., it is a mind's drawing up a conclusion or coming to a choice between two things or more proposed to it. But determining among external objects of choice is not the same as determining the act of choice itself among various possible acts of choice. The question is, what influences, directs, or determines the mind or will to such a conclusion or choice as it does form? Or what is the cause, ground, or reason why it concludes thus and not otherwise? This is a question on his own statement. Moving forward to chapter 23, sickness of Mr. Edwards, God's last end in creation, nature of virtue, Mr. Edwards' second son resides at Anahaqui, dangers of the war, letter to Mr. Erskine, and so on. In July 1754, Mr. Edwards had a most severe attack of the ague and fever, which lasted until January. It wholly disqualified him from writing even to his correspondents, and greatly enfeebled his constitution. In the course of the spring following, he began the preparation of two other treatises, which were entitled A Dissertation Concerning the End for Which God Created the World, and A Dissertation Concerning the Nature of True Virtue. These two subjects are fundamental in a system of theology. On the first, many writers had hazarded occasional remarks, yet it has rarely occupied the space even of a chapter or a section in theological systems, and I know not whether any writer before Mr. Edwards had made it the subject of a formal and separate treatise. From the purest principles of reason, as well as from the fountain of revealed truth, he demonstrates that the chief and ultimate end of the Supreme Being in the works of creation and providence was a manifestation of his own glory in the highest happiness of his creatures. The treatise was left by the author as at first written without being prepared for the press, yet it exhibits the subject in a manner so clear and convincing that it has been the manual of theologians from the time of its publication to the present. The nature of virtue has been a frequent subject of discussion among ethical writers of almost every class, heathen, infidel, and Christian. Aristotle and other ancient moralists supposed virtue to consist in avoiding extremes and in following the mean in everything. Others of the ancients defined virtue to be living according to nature. Balguy and Doddridge represented this consisting in acting agreeably to the moral fitness of things. Wollaston places it in regard to truth. George Hutcheson defines it to be a quality apprehended in some actions which produces approbation and love towards the actor from those who receive no benefit from the action. Many writers, ancient and modern, have placed virtue in imitation of God, and many others in obedience to the will of God. Waterland, Rutherford, and John Brown have placed it in a wise regard to our own interest. Bishop Butler says that, quote, to do concern about our own interest or happiness in a reasonable endeavor to promote it is virtue, end quote, and that benevolence singly considered is in no sort the whole of virtue. Hume, who appears to have read several of the works of Edwards and to have made use of them in accommodation to his own views, includes in his description of virtue whatever is agreeable and useful to ourselves and others. Adam Smith refers it to the principle of sympathy. William Paley, who read Edwards with care, defines virtue to be the doing good to mankind in obedience to the will of God and for the sake of everlasting happiness. Cumberland, in his Laws of Nature, justly regards it as consisting in the love of God and of our fellow creatures, and explains himself thus, quote, the foundation of all natural law is the greatest benevolence of every rational agent towards all. Mr. Edwards represents virtue as founded in happiness, and as being love to the greatest happiness, or love to the happiness of universal being. He describes it as leading its possessor to desire and to promote, as far as in him lies, the happiness of all beings, and a greater degree of happiness in preference to a less. His account of the subject is in exact accordance with the decision of reason. Happiness is the end for which intelligent beings were made, the perfection of their existence, and therefore virtue or moral excellence must be loved to that happiness. It is also in exact accordance with the scriptures. The sum of our duty is unquestionably virtue, but Moses sums up our duty in two commands, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. In other words, thou shalt love the happiness of universal being. When the scriptures had so plainly pointed out the nature of virtue as consisting in love and in its foundation as being happiness, it is not a little remarkable that so many acute writers with the scriptures in their hands should have formed views either so obscure or so erroneous of these subjects, and perhaps not less remarkable that Mr. Edwards should have been able to discover its true nature and its real foundation at a very early age as clearly he did in after life. That this was the case, no one will want evidence who reads the various articles under the heads of excellency, particularly the last and the notes on the mind. These two treatises were first published together in a pamphlet in Boston in 1788 without alteration from the rough draft of the author. He designs them both for publication but never prepared either of them for the press. Though conceived and expressed with great perspicuity, they treat of subjects which demand close thought in the reader as well as the writer, and on this account have often been imperfectly comprehended even by divines. But wherever they have been read and understood, they have to such a degree formed and regulated the views of theologians with regard to the subjects of which they treat, that other treatises are consulted rather as objects of curiosity or history than as guides of opinions and principles. In 1751, an anonymous work was published in Edinburgh entitled Essays on the Principles of Morality and Natural Religion, of which Henry Holm soon avowed himself the author. These essays, though written by a member of the Church of Scotland, were regarded as decidedly skeptical in their tendency and brought the author into some difficulties with the particular church with which he was connected. This led to a public discussion of the character of the work at large, particularly of the essay on liberty and necessity. When this discussion was commencing, the essay on the freedom of the will arrived in Scotland. It was extensively read by men of speculative minds, and though presented a view of the subjects wholly new, gave great satisfaction to men of all classes. Lord Kames and his friends, having read the work of Mr. Edwards, endeavored to show that the view of liberty and necessity in the freedom of the will was substantially the same with that given by his lordship. Mr. Erskine apprised Mr. Edwards of this fact. In the following letter, the latter barely alludes to the work of Lord Kames as a work of corrupt tendency. In a subsequent letter to his friends, written in the summer of the following year and now appended to the treatise on the freedom of the will, he examines the views of liberty and necessity by his lordship, shows their entire discordance with his own views as exhibited in the freedom of the will, and exposes their inconsistency not only with reason but with each other. This letter, from a sense of justice to its author, was immediately published in the form of a pamphlet by Mr. Erskine, and produced a universal conviction that Lord Kames had wholly misunderstood the view taken of liberty and necessity by Mr. Edwards, and that his own views of it were at war alike with reason and revelation. Indeed, his lordship himself appears to have been of the same opinion, for in a subsequent edition, the essay on liberty and necessity is said to have been much changed, as to present essentially different views of those important subjects. It is probable that Jonathan Edwards began his treatise on original sin about this period, and that he devoted the leisure hours of the summer, autumn, and winter to the preparation of that work. The date of the author's preface, May 26, 1757, shows the time when it was finished for the press. The views of Mr. Edwards in this treatise are these, that there is a tendency in human nature prevailing and effectual to that sin, which implies the utter ruin of all, that this tendency originates in the sin of Adam, of which the whole race are imputed the partakers, and that this tendency consists in their being left of God at their original, in the possession of merely human appetites and passions in themselves, innocent, and without the influx of those superior principles which come from divine influences. The only guilt attributed by him to mankind before they come to the exercise of moral agency themselves is that of participating in the apostasy of Adam, in consequence of the original constitution of God, which made him and his race one. He supposes his tendency to sin pertaining to men at their original to constitute the subject of it a sinner only, because he regards him as a participator in that sin by which Adam apostatized with his whole race. This tendency he calls sinful, corrupt, odious, and so on, because it is a tendency to that moral evil by which the subject of it becomes odious in the sight of God, Part 1, Chapter 2, Section 3. He supposes that infants who have this tendency in their nature are as yet sinners only by the one act or offense of Adam, and that they have not renewed the act of sin themselves, Part 1, Chapter 4. He utterly denies any positive agency of God in producing sin, and resolves the tendency to sin into the innocent principles of human nature, which God might create without sin, and the withholding of that positive influence from which spring superior and divine principles, which act of withholding is not infusing or positively creating anything. These innocent principles, such as hunger and thirst, love and hatred, desire, fear, joy and sorrow, and self-love, as distinguished from selfishness, which are necessary to the nature of man, and belong to him, whether holy or sinful, or not in his view sin. They barely constitute the ground of certainty that the being who has them will sin as soon as he is capable of sinning, if that positive influence from which spring superior and divine principles is withheld, and in this relation they are spoken of under the general designation a tendency, a propensity, and so on to sin. The views of imputation contained in this work are such as has been long and extensively entertained, yet some of them certainly are not generally received at present. With this exception, the treatise on original sin is regarded as a standard work on the subject of which it treats, and is doubtless the ablest defense of the doctrine of human depravity, and of the doctrine that that depravity is a consequence of the sin of Adam which has hitherto appeared. The father of Mr. Edwards, as the reader may remember, on account of the increasing infirmities of age, had requested his people to settle a colleague in the ministry in 1752, but continued to preach to them regularly until the summer of 1755, when he was in the 87th year. The following letter, probably the last ever written to him by his own son, shows a gradual decline of his health and strength during the two following years. To the Reverend Timothy Edwards at East Windsor, March 24th, 1757. Honored sir, I take this opportunity just to inform you that through the goodness of God we are all in a comfortable state of health, and that we have heard not long since of the welfare of our children in New Jersey and Northampton. I intend, God willing, to be at Windsor sometime near the beginning of June, proposing then to go a journey to Boston. I intended to have gone sooner, but I foresee such hindrances as will probably prevent my going till that time. We rejoice much to hear by Mr. Andrew's son of your being so well as to be able to baptize a child at your own house the Sabbath before last. We all unite in duty to you and my honored mother, and in respectful and affectionate salutations to sisters and cousins, and in a request of a constant remembrance in your prayers, I am, honored sir, your dutiful son, Jonathan Edwards. Not long after Mr. Edwards had forwarded to Mr. Erskine his vindication of himself against the charge of having advanced in the freedom of the will the same views of liberty and necessity with those exhibited by Lord Kames, he received from his friend a pamphlet entitled Objections to the Essays on the Principles of Morality and Natural Religion Examined, in which the opinion was directly advanced that if it were really true, as Mr. Edwards had insisted and demonstrated in the freedom of the will, that there is no liberty of contingence nor self-determining power in the will, as opposed to moral necessity or the certain connection between motives and volitions. Yet it was best for mankind that the truth in this respect should not be known, because in that case they would not regard either themselves or others as deserving of praise or blame for their conduct. In the following letter, Mr. Edwards exposes the folly and absurdity of this opinion, and explains in a remarkably clear and convincing manner the practical bearing of the great principles advanced in the freedom of the will on the subject of salvation. This letter might well have been published at the time and circulated through the church at large, and we recommend it to the frequent and prayerful perusal both of those ministers who cannot clearly comprehend the distinction between physical and moral inability, and of those who do not perceive the importance of explaining and enforcing this distinction from the pulpit as exhibiting the consequences of representing impenitent sinners to be possessed of any other inability to repent and believe than mere unwillingness in a manner too awful to be resisted by a conscientious mind. To Mr. Erskine, Stockbridge, August 3rd, 1757. Reverend and dear sir, in June last I received a letter from you dated January 22nd, 1757, with Mr. Anderson's complaint verified, an objection to the essays examined. For these things I now return you my hearty thanks. The conduct of the vindicator of the essays from objections made against them seems to be very odd. Many things are produced from Calvin and several Calvinistic writers to defend what is not objected against. His book is almost wholly taken up about that which is nothing to the purpose, perhaps only to amuse and blind the common people. According to your proposal, I have drawn up something stating the difference between my hypothesis and that of the essays, which I have sent to you to be printed in Scotland if it be thought best, or to be disposed of as you think proper. I have written it in a letter to you, and if it be published, it may be as a letter from me to a minister in Scotland. Lord Kames' notion of God's deceiving mankind by a kind, invincible, or natural instinct or feeling, leading them to suppose that they have a liberty of contingence and self-determination of will, in order to make them believe themselves and others worthy to be blamed or praised for what they do, is a strange notion indeed, and it is hard for me to conjecture what its use could be in publishing such things to the world. However, by what I have heard, some others seem to be so far of the same mind that they think that if it be really true that there is no self-determining power in the will, as opposed to any such moral necessity as I speak of, consisting in a certain connection between motives and volitions, it is of a mischievous tendency to say anything of it, and that it is best that the truth in this manner should not be known by any means. I cannot but be of an extremely different mind. On the contrary, I think that the notion of liberty consisting in a contingent self-determination action of the will is necessary to the morality of men's dispositions and actions is almost inconceivably pernicious, and that the contrary truth is one of the most important truths of moral philosophy that ever was discussed, and most necessary to be known, is that for want of it, those schemes of morality and religion which are a kind of infidel schemes entirely diverse from the virtue and religion of the Bible, and wholly inconsistent with and subversive of the main things belonging to the gospel scheme, have so vastly and so long prevailed and have stood in such strength. And I think whoever imagines that he or anybody else shall ever see the doctrines of grace effectually maintained against these adversaries, till the truth in this manner be settled, imagines a vain thing. For allow these adversaries what they maintain in this point, and I think they have strict demonstration against us, and not only have these errors a most pernicious influence in the public religious controversies that are maintained in the world, but such sort of notions have a more fatal influence many ways on the minds of all ranks in all transactions between God and their souls. The longer I live, and the more I have to do with the souls of men in the work of the ministry, the more I see of this. Notions of this sort are one of the main hindrances of the success of the preaching of the word and other means of grace and the conversion of sinners. This especially appears when the minds of sinners are affected with some concern for their souls and they are stirred up to seek their salvation. Nothing is more necessary for men in such circumstances than thorough conviction and humiliation, than that their consciences should be properly convinced of their real guilt and sinfulness in the sight of God and their deserving of His wrath. But who is there that has had experience of the work of a minister in dealing with souls in such circumstances that does not find that the thing that mainly prevents is men's excusing themselves with their own inability and the moral necessity of those things wherein their exceeding guilt and sinfulness in the sight of God most fundamentally and mainly consists, such as living from day to day without one spark of true love to the God of infinite glory and the fountain of all good, their having greater complacency in the little vile things of this world than in Him, their living in a rejection of Christ with all His glorious benefits and dying love, and after all the exhibitions of His glory and grace, having their hearts still as cold as a stone towards Him, and their living in such ingratitude for that infinite mercy of His laying down His life for sinners, they, it may be, think of some instances of lewd behavior, lying, dishonesty, intemperance, profaneness, and so on, but the grand principles of iniquity constantly abiding and reigning from whence all proceeds are all overlooked. Conscience does not condemn them for those things because they cannot love God of themselves, they cannot believe of themselves, and the like. They rather lay the blame of these things and their other reigning wicked dispositions of heart to God and secretly charge Him with all the blame. These things are very much for want of being thoroughly instructed in that great and important truth that a bad will or an evil disposition of heart itself is wickedness. It is wickedness in its very being, nature, and essence, and not merely the occasion of it, or the determining influence that it was at first owing to. Some, it may be, will say, they own it is their fault that they have so bad a heart, that they have no love to God, no true faith in Christ, no gratitude to Him, because they have been careless and slothful in times past, and have not used means to obtain a better heart as they should have done. And it may be they are taught that they are to blame for their wickedness of heart because they, as it were, brought it on themselves and Adam by the sin which he voluntarily committed, which sin is justly charged to their account, which perhaps they do not deny. But how far are these things from being a proper conviction of their wickedness and their enmity to God and Christ? To be convinced of the sin of something that long ago was the occasion of their enmity to God, and to be convinced of the wickedness of the enmity itself are quite two things. And if sinners under some awakening find the exercise of corruption of heart, as it appears in a great many ways, in their meditations, prayers, and other religious duties, and on the occasions of their fears of hell and so on and so on, still this notion of their inability to help it excusing them will keep them from proper conviction of sin herein. Fears of hell tend to convince men of the hardness of their hearts, but then when they find how hard their hearts are and how far from a proper sensibility and affection in things of religion, they are kept from properly condemning themselves for it, from the moral necessity or inability which attends it. For the very notion of hardness of heart implies moral inability. ability, the harder the heart is, the more dead is it in sin, and the more unable to exert good affections and acts. Thus the strength of sin is made the excuse for sin. And thus I have known many under fears of hell justifying or excusing themselves, at least implicitly, in horrid workings of enmity against God, in blasphemous thoughts, and so on. It is of great importance that they that are seeking their salvation should be brought out from all dependence on their own righteousness, but these notions above all things prevent it. They justify themselves in the sincerity of their endeavors. They say to themselves that they do what they can. They take great pains, and though there be great imperfection in what they do, and many evil workings of heart arise, yet these they cannot help. Here moral necessity or inability comes in as an excuse. Things of this kind have visibly been the main hindrance of the true humiliation and conversion of sinners in the times of awakening that have been in this land. Everywhere and in all parts, as I have had opportunity to observe in very many places, when the gospel is preached and its offers and invitations and motives most powerfully urged, and some hearts stand out, here is their stronghold, their sheet anchor. Were it not for this, they would either comply or their hearts would condemn them for their horrid guilt in not complying. And if the law of God be preached in its strictness and spirituality, yet conscience is not properly convinced by it, they justify themselves with their inability, and the design and end of the law as a schoolmaster to fit them for Christ is defeated. Thus both the law and the gospel are prevented from having their proper effect. The doctrine of a self-determining will is the ground of all moral good and evil, tends to prevent any proper exercises of faith in God and Christ in the affair of our salvation, as it tends to prevent all dependence upon them. For instead of this, it teaches a kind of absolute independence on all those things that are of chief importance in this affair, our righteousness depending originally on our own acts as self-determined. Thus our own holiness is from ourselves as its determining cause and its original and highest source. As for imputed righteousness, that should have any merit at all in it, to be sure there can be no such thing, for self-determination is necessary to praise and merit. But what is imputed from another is not from our self-determination or action. And truly, in this scheme, man is not dependent on God, but God is rather dependent on man in this affair, for he only operates consequentially in acts in which he depends on what he sees we determine and do first. The nature of true faith implies a disposition to give all the glory of our salvation to God and Christ. But this notion is inconsistent with it, for it in effect gives a glory wholly to man. For that is the very doctrine that is taught, that the merit and praise is his, whose is the original and effectual determination of the praiseworthy deed. So that, on the whole, I think it must be a miracle if ever men are converted that have imbibed such notions as these, and are under their influence in their religious concerns. Yea, these notions tend effectually to prevent men's ever seeking after conversion with any earnestness. It is manifest that men never will be in earnest in this manner till their consciences are awakened and they are made sensible of God's anger, and their danger of suffering the terrible effects of it. But that stupidity which is opposed to this awakening is upheld chiefly by these two things, their insensibility of their guilt in what is past and present, and their flattering themselves as to what is future. These notions of liberty of indifference, contingence, and self-determination, as essential to guilt or merit, tend to preclude all sense of any great guilt for past or present wickedness, as has been observed already. All wickedness of heart is excused as what in itself considered brings no guilt, and all that the conscience has to recur to find any guilt is the first wrong determination of the will and some bad conduct before that wickedness of heart existed that was the occasion of introducing or confirming it, which determination arose contingently from a state of indifference. And how small a matter does this at once bring men's guilt to, when all the main things wherein this wickedness consists are passed over. And indeed, the more these principles are pursued, the more and more must guilt vanish till at last it comes to nothing, as may easily be shown. And with respect to self-flattery and presumption as to what is future, nothing can possibly be conceived more directly tending to it than a notion of liberty at all times possessed, consisting in a power to determine one's own will to good or evil, which implies a power men have at all times to determine them to repent and turn to God. And what can more effectually encourage the sinner in present delays and neglects and embolden him to go on in sin in a presumption of having his own salvation at all times at his command? And this notion of self-determination isolation and self-dependence tends to prevent or innervate all prayers to God for converting grace. For why should men earnestly cry to God for His grace to determine their hearts to that which they must be determined to of themselves? And indeed, it destroys the very notion of conversion itself. There can properly be no such thing or anything akin to what the Scripture speaks of conversion, renovation of the heart, regeneration, and so on, if growing good by a number of self-determined acts are all that is required or to be expected. Excuse me, sir, for troubling you so much with this head. I speak from the fullness of my heart. What I have long seen of the dreadful consequences of these prevalent notions everywhere, and what I am convinced will still be their consequences so long as they continue to prevail, fills me with concern. I therefore wish that the affair were more thoroughly looked into and searched to the very bottom. I have reserved a copy of this letter and also my other to you, dated July 25th, intended to send them to Mr. Burr, to be by him conveyed by the way of New York or Philadelphia. Looking on these letters as of special importance, I send duplicates, lest one copy should fail. The packet in which I enclose this, I cover to Mr. Gillies and send to Boston to the care of Mr. Hislop to be conveyed to Mr. Gillies, but yet have desired him, if he has a more direct opportunity, to convey the packet to Edinburgh by the way of London, and to put a wrapper over the whole inscribed to you, and to write to you, desiring you to break open the packet and take out the letters which belong to you. You will see, sir, something of our sorrowful state on this side of the water by my letter to Mr. McCulloch. Oh, sir, pray for us, and pray in particular for your affectionate and obliged friend and brother, Jonathan Edwards. Chapter 24. Death of President Aaron Burr, his character, Mr. Edwards chosen his successor, and so on. The Reverend Aaron Burr, president of the College of Princeton and son-in-law of Mr. Edwards, died on the 24th of September, 1757, 2 days before the public commencement. He was a native of Fairfield, Connecticut, was born in 1716, and was graduated at Yale College in 1735. In 1738, he was ordained as pastor of the Presbyterian Church at Newark. In 1748, he was unanimously elected president of the college as successor to Mr. Dickinson. Though possessed of a slender and delicate constitution, he joined to uncommon talents for the dispatch of business, a constancy of mind that commonly secured to him success. The flourishing state of the college at the time of his death was chiefly owing to his great and assiduous exertions. Until the autumn of 1755, he discharged the duties both of president and pastor of the church. Mr. Burr was greatly respected in every situation and relation of life. He was a man of acknowledged talents, of sound, practical good sense, of unimpeachable integrity, and of ardent piety. Polished in his manners, he had an uncommon powers in conversation and possessed a happy art of inspiring all around him with cheerfulness. As a reasoner, he was clear and solid, and as a preacher, animated, judicious, fervent, and successful. He had warm affections, was greatly endeared to his family and friends, and was open, fair, and honorable in all his intercourse with mankind. During the period of his presidency, he secured the high esteem and confidence of all who were interested in the college. In the latter part of July, or the beginning of August, being in a low state of health, he made a rapid and exhausting visit to Stockbridge in a very hot, sultry season. He soon returned to Princeton and went immediately to Elizabethtown, where on the 19th of August, he made an attempt before the legislature to procure the legal exemption of the students from military duty. On the 21st, at Newark, being much indisposed, he preached an extemporaneous funeral sermon in consequence of a death in the family of his successor. He then returned to Princeton, and in a few days went to Philadelphia on the business of the college. On the way, his disorder took the form of an intermittent fever. On his return, he learned that his friend, Governor Belcher, died at Elizabethtown on the 31st of August, and that he had been designated to preach the funeral sermon. His wife, perceiving his increasing illness, besought him to spare himself and decline the undertaking, but he felt himself bound, if possible, to perform it. Having devoted the afternoon of September 2nd to the task of preparing a sermon in the midst of a high fever, which was succeeded by delirium in the night, he rode on the next day to Elizabethtown, about 40 miles, and on the 4th, in a state of extreme languor and exhaustion, when it was obvious to everyone that he ought to have been confined to a sick bed, he with great difficulty preached a sermon. He returned to Princeton the following day, and his disorder immediately assumed the character of a fixed and violent fever seated on the nerves. At the approach of death, that gospel which he had preached to others gave him unfailing support. He was patient and resigned and cheered with the liveliest hope of a happy immortality. The corporation of the college met 2 days after his death, and on the same day made choice of Mr. Edwards as his successor. Some of the circumstances connected with the sickness and death of her husband are alluded to in the following letter from Mrs. Burr to a gentleman in Scotland, written soon after Mr. Burr's decease. "Honored sir, I flatter myself I shall not be thought intrusive if I acknowledge in a few lines the receipt of your letter, dated in August, to my late dear husband, which reached me after he was beyond the reach of all mortal things. The affectionate regard that you express for one who is dearer to me than my own life was extremely affecting to me, nor can I forgive myself if I neglect to acknowledge it in terms of lively gratitude. You, sir, had a large share with me in that dear good man's heart, which he often expressed with the warmest affection. I thought it might not be improper to lay your letter before the trustees, as they were then convened, and it chiefly concerned the college, and then I sent it to my honored father, the Reverend Mr. Edwards, who has chosen to succeed my dear husband, which I hope will be grateful to the friends of the college in Scotland. I here enclose you, sir, the last attempt my dear husband made to serve God in public, and to do good to his fellow creatures, a sermon that he preached at the funeral of our late excellent governor. You will not think it strange if it has imperfections when I tell you that all he wrote on the subject was done in a part of one afternoon and evening, when he had a violent fever on him, and the whole night after he was irrational. Give me leave to beg an interest in your prayers at the throne of grace for a poor disconsolate widow and 2 fatherless orphans. Please to present with great respect my kindest regard to your lady and daughters. I am, honored sir, your most obliged and humble servant, Esther Burr." The 2 following extracts from letters written soon after the death of Mr. Burr will show the strength of her own feelings, as well as her religious sentiments and the exercises of her heart. The first is from a letter to a near friend of the family in Boston. "Your most kind letter of condolence gave me inexpressible delight, and at the same time set open afresh all the avenues of grief, and again probed the deep wound death has given me. My loss, shall I attempt to say how great my loss is? God only can know, and to him alone would I carry my complaint. Indeed, sir, I have lost all that was or could be desirable in a creature. I have lost all that ever I set my heart on in this world. I need not enlarge on the innumerable amiable qualities of my late dear husband to one that was so well acquainted with him as you were, however pleasing it is to me to dwell on them. Had not God supported me by these 2 considerations, first by showing the right he has to his own creatures to dispose of them when and what manner he pleases, and secondly by enabling me to follow him beyond the grave into the eternal world and there to view him in unspeakable glory and happiness freed from all sin and sorrow. I should long before this have been sunk among the dead and been covered with the clods of the valley. God has wise ends in all that he doth. This thing did not come upon me by chance, and I rejoice that I am in the hands of such a God." The other is from a letter to her mother, dated at Princeton, October 7, 1757. After giving some account of Mr. Burr's death, and representing the sense she had of the greatness of the loss which she and her children had sustained, she writes in the following words: "No doubt, dear madam, it will be some comfort to you to hear that God has not utterly forsaken, although he has cast down. I would speak it to the glory of God's name that I think he has in an uncommon degree discovered himself to be an all-sufficient God, a full fountain of all good. Although all streams were cut off, yet the fountain is left full. I think I have been enabled to cast my care upon him and have found great peace and calmness in my mind such as this world cannot give nor take. I have had uncommon freedom and nearness to the throne of grace. God has seemed sensibly near in such a supporting and comfortable manner that I think I have never experienced the like. God has helped me to review my past and present mercies with some heart-affecting degree of thankfulness. I think God has given me such a sense of the vanity of the world and uncertainty of all sublunary enjoyments as I never had before. The world vanishes out of my sight. Heavenly and eternal things appear much more real and important than ever before. I feel myself to be under much greater obligations to be the Lord's than before this sore affliction. The way of salvation by faith in Jesus Christ has appeared more clear and excellent, and I have been constrained to venture my all upon Him and have found great peace of soul in what I hope has been the actings of faith. Some parts of the Psalms have been very comforting and refreshing to my soul. I hope God has helped me to eye His hand in this awful dispensation, and to see the infinite right He has to His own, and to dispose of them as He pleases. Thus, dear madam, I have given you some broken hints of the exercises and supports of my mind, since the death of Him whose memory and example will ever be precious to me is my own life. Oh, dear madam, I doubt not, but I have your and my honored father's prayers daily for me. But give me leave to entreat you both to request earnestly of the Lord that I may never despise His chastenings, nor faint under this His severe stroke, of which I am sensible there is great danger if God should only deny me the supports He has hitherto graciously granted. Oh, I am afraid I shall conduct myself so as to bring dishonor on my God and the religion which I profess. No, rather let me die this moment than be left to bring dishonor on God's holy name. I am overcome. I must conclude with once more begging that, as my dear parents remember themselves, they would not forget their greatly afflicted daughter, now a lonely widow, nor her fatherless children. My duty to my ever dear and honored parents, and love to my brothers and sisters. From, dear madam, your dutiful and affectionate daughter, Esther Burr. The news of his appointment to the presidency, says Dr. Hopkins, was quite unexpected and not a little surprising to Mr. Edwards. He looked on himself in many respects so unqualified for that business that he wondered that gentlemen of so good judgment and so well acquainted with him as he knew some of the trustees were should think of him for that place. He had many objections in his own mind against undertaking the business, both from his unfitness and his particular circumstances, yet could not certainly determine that it was not his duty to accept it. The following extract of a letter which he wrote to the trustees will give the reader a view of the sentiments and exercises on this occasion, as well as of the great designs he was deeply engaged in and zealously prosecuting. Stockbridge, October 19, 1757. Reverend and honored gentlemen, I was not a little surprised on receiving the unexpected notice of your having made choice of me to succeed the late President Burr as the head of Nassau Hall. I am much in doubt whether I am called to undertake the business which you have done me the unmerited honor to choose me for. If some regard may be had to my outward comfort, I might mention the many inconveniences and great detriment which may be sustained by my removing with my numerous family, so far from all the estate I have in the world, without any prospect of disposing of it under present circumstances, but with great loss. Now, when we have scarcely got over the trouble and damage sustained by our removal from Northampton, and have but just begun to have our affairs in a comfortable situation for a subsistence in this place, and the expense I must immediately be put at to put myself into the circumstances tolerably comporting with the needful support of the honors of the office I am invited to, which will not well consist with my ability. But this is not my main objection. The chief difficulties in my mind in the way of accepting this important and arduous office are these two. First, my own defects unfitting me for such an undertaking, many of which are generally known, besides others of which my own heart is conscious. I have a constitution in many respects peculiarly unhappy, attended with flaccid solids, vapid sizing, scarce fluids, and a low tide of spirits, often occasioning a kind of childish weakness and contemptibleness of speech, presence, and demeanor, with a disagreeable dullness and stiffness, much unfitting me for conversation, but more especially for the government of a college. This makes me shrink at the thoughts of taking upon me in the decline of life such a new and great business, attended with such a multiplicity of cares, and requiring such a degree of activity, alertness, and spirit of government, especially as succeeding one so remarkably well qualified in these respects, giving occasion to everyone to remark the wide difference. I am also deficient in some parts of learning, particularly in algebra and the higher parts of mathematics and the Greek classics, my Greek learning having been chiefly in the New Testament. The other thing is this, that my engaging in this business will not well consist with those views and that course of employ in my study which have long engaged and swallowed up my mind and been the chief entertainment and delight of my life. And here, honored sirs, emboldened by the testimony I have now received of your unmerited esteem to rely on your candor, I will with freedom open myself to you. My method of study from my first beginning the work of the ministry has been very much by writing, applying myself in this way to improve every important hint, pursuing the clue to my utmost. When anything in reading, meditation, or conversation has been suggested to my mind that seemed to promise light in any weighty point, thus pinning what appeared to me my best thoughts on innumerable subjects for my own benefit. The longer I prosecuted my studies in this method, the more habitual it became, and the more pleasant and profitable I found it. The farther I traveled in this way, the more and wider the field opened, which has occasioned my laying out many things in my mind to do this in a manner, if God should spare my life, which my heart hath been much upon, particularly many things against most of the prevailing errors of the present day, which I cannot with any patience see maintain, to the utter subverting of the gospel of Christ, with so high a hand and so long continued a triumph, with so little control, when it appears so evident to me that there is truly no foundation for any of this glory. An insult. I have already published something on one of the main points in dispute between the Arminians and Calvinists, and have it in view, God willing, as I have already signified to the public, in like manner to consider all the other controverted points, and have done much towards the preparation for it. But besides these, I have had on my mind and heart, which I long ago began, not with any view to publication, a great work which I call a history of the work of redemption, a body of divinity in an entire new method being thrown into the form of a history. Considering the affair of Christian theology as a whole of it, and each part stands in reference to the great work of redemption by Jesus Christ, which I suppose to be of all others the grand design of God and the summum and ultimum of all the divine operations and decrees, particularly considering all parts of the grand scheme in their historical order, the order of their existence, or their being brought forth to view in the course of divine dispensations, or the wonderful series of successive acts and events, beginning from eternity and descending from thence to the great work and successive dispensations of the infinitely wise God in time, considering the chief events coming to pass in the Church of God and revolutions in the world of mankind, affecting the state of the Church in the affair of redemption, which we have an account of in history or prophecy, till at last we come to the general resurrection, last judgment, and consummation of all things, when it shall be said, "It is done, I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end." Concluding my work with the consideration of that perfect state of things which shall be finally settled to last for eternity. This history will be carried on with regard to all three worlds, heaven, earth, and hell, considering the connected successive events and alterations in each, so far as the scriptures give any light, introducing all parts of divinity in that order which is most scriptural and most natural, a method which appears to me the most beautiful and entertaining, wherein every divine doctrine will appear to the greatest advantage and the brightest light in the most striking manner, showing the admirable contexture and harmony of the whole. I have also, for my own profit and entertainment, done much towards another great work, which I call the Harmony of the Old and New Testament in three parts. The first, considering the prophecies of the Messiah, his redemption and kingdom, the evidences of their references to the Messiah, and so on, comparing them all one with another, demonstrating their agreement, true scope, and sense, also considering all the various particulars wherein those prophecies have their exact fulfillment, showing the universal, precise, and admirable correspondence between predictions and events. The second part, considering the types of the Old Testament, showing the evidence of their being intended as representations of the great things of the gospel of Christ, and the agreement of the type with the anti-type. The third and great part, considering the harmony of the Old and New Testament as to doctrine and precept. In the course of this work, I find there will be occasion for an explanation of a very great part of the Holy Scriptures, which may, in such a view, be explained in a method which to me seems the most entertaining and profitable, thus tending to lead the mind to a view of the true spirit, design, life, and soul of the Scriptures, as well as their proper use and improvement. I have also many other things in hand, and some of which I have made great progress, which I will not trouble you with an account of. Some of these things, if divine providence favor, I should be willing to attempt a publication of. So far as myself am able to judge of what talents I have for benefiting my fellow creatures by word, I think I can write better than I can speak. My heart is so much in these studies that I cannot find it in my heart to be willing to put myself into an incapacity to pursue them any more in the future part of my life. to such a degree as I must if I undertake to go through the same course of employ in the office of president that Mr. Burr did, instructing in all the languages and taking the whole care of the instruction of one of the classes in all parts of learning besides his other labors. If I should see light to determine me to accept a place offered me, I should be willing to take upon me the work of a president, so far as it consists in the general inspection of the whole society, and to be subservient to the school, as to their order and methods of study and instruction, assisting myself in the immediate instruction in the arts and sciences, as discretion should direct and occasion serve and the state of things require, especially of the senior class, and added to all, should be willing to do the whole work of a professor of divinity in public and private lectures, proposing questions to be answered and some to be discussed in writing and free conversation, in meetings of graduates and others appointed in proper seasons for these ends. It would be now out of my way to spend time in a constant teaching of the languages, unless it be the Hebrew tongue, which I should be willing to improve myself in by instructing others. On the whole, I am much at a loss with respect to the way of duty in this important affair. I am in doubt whether if I should engage in it, I should not do what both you and I would be very sorry for afterwards. Nevertheless, I think the greatness of the affair and the regard due to so worthy and venerable a body as that of the trustees of Nassau Hall requires my taking the matter into serious consideration. And unless you should appear to be discouraged by the things which I have now represented as to any further expectation from me, I shall proceed to ask advice of such as I esteem most wise, friendly, and faithful. If after the mind of the commissioners in Boston is known, it appears that they consent to leave me at liberty with respect to the business they have employed me in here. Soon after the death of President Burr, Mr. Edwards addressed a letter to his greatly afflicted daughter, fraught with all the affectionate instruction and consolation which such a father could impart. To this she returned a following answer. To the Reverend Jonathan Edwards Stockbridge, Princeton, November 2, 1757. To my ever-honored father, honored sir, your most affectionate comforting letter by my brother Parsons was exceeding refreshing to me, although I was somewhat damped by hearing that I should not see you until spring. But it is my comfort in this disappointment, as well as under all my affliction, that God knows what is best for me and for his own glory. Perhaps I counted too much on the company and conversation of such a near and dear affectionate father and guide. I cannot doubt but all is for the best, and I am satisfied that God should order the affair of your removal as shall be for his glory whatever becomes of me. Since I wrote my mother a letter, God has carried me through new trials and given me new supports. My little son has been sick with a slow fever ever since my brother left us and has been brought to the brink of the grave, but I hope in mercy God is bringing him back again. I was enabled, after a severe struggle with nature, to resign the child with the greatest freedom. God showed me that the children were not my own but his, and that he had a right to recall what he had lent whenever he thought fit, and that I had no reason to complain or say that God was hard with me. This silenced me, but oh, how good is God! He not only kept me from complaining, but comforted me by enabling me to offer up my child by faith if ever I acted faith. I saw the fullness there was in Christ for little infants, and his willingness to accept of such as were offered to him. Suffer little children to come unto me, and forbid them not, were comforting words. God also showed me in such a lively manner the fullness there was in himself of all spiritual blessings, that I said, although all streams were cut off, yet so long as my God lives, I have enough. He enabled me to say, although thou slay me, yet will I trust in thee. In this time of trial, I was led to enter into a renewed and explicit covenant with God in a more solemn manner than ever before. And with the greatest freedom and delight, after much self-examination and prayer, I did give myself and my children to God with my whole heart. Never until then had I an adequate sense of the privilege we are allowed in covenanting with God. This act of soul left my mind in a great calm and steady trust in God. A few days after this, one evening, in talking of the glorious state of my dear departed husband must be in, my soul was carried out in such large desires after that glorious state that I was forced to retire from the family to conceal my joy. When alone, I was so transported, and my soul carried out in such eager desires after perfection and the full enjoyment of God as to serve Him uninterruptedly, that I think my nature would not have borne much more. I think, dear sir, I had that night a foretaste of heaven. This frame continued in some good degree the whole night. I slept but little, and when I did, my dreams were all of heavenly and divine things. Frequently since, I have felt the same in kind, though not in degree. This is about the time that God called me to give up my child. Thus a kind and gracious God has been with me in 6 troubles and in 7. But, O sir, what cause of deep humiliation and abasement of soul have I on account of remaining corruption, which I see working continually in me, especially pride? Oh, how many shapes does pride cloak itself in? Satan is also busy shooting his darts. But blessed be God, those temptations of his that used to overthrow me as yet have not touched me. I will just hint at one or two, if I am not tedious as to length. When I was about to renew my covenant with God, the suggestion seemed to arise in my mind, it is better you should not renew it than break it when you have. What a dreadful thing it will be if you do not keep it. My reply was, I did not do it in my own strength. Then the suggestion would return, how do you know that God will help you to keep it? But it did not shake me in the least. Oh, to be delivered from the power of Satan as well as sin. I cannot help hoping the time is near. God has certainly fitted me for himself, and when I think that it will be soon that I shall be called hence, the thought is transporting. I am afraid I have tired out your patience, and will beg leave only to add my need of the earnest prayers of my dear and honored parents and all good people that I may not at last be cast away, but that God would constantly grant me new supplies of divine grace. I am tenderly concerned for my dear brother Timothy, but I hope his sickness will not be unto death, but for the glory of God. Please to give my duty to my honored mother, and my love to all my brothers and sisters. I am honored and dear, sir, with the greatest respect, your affectionate and dutiful daughter, Esther Burr. Well, Mr. Edwards was in a state of suspense alluded to in his letter to the trustees of the college. He determined to ask the advice of a number of gentlemen in the ministry on whose judgment and friendship he could rely and to act accordingly. One of those invited on this occasion was his old and faithful friend and former pupil, Mr. Bellamy of Bethlehem, to whom, having received from him on the last day of November 2 letters dated on the 12th and 17th of that month, he returned on the next day the following answer, which, while it refers to the subject of the council, shows also in a very striking manner with what ease and readiness he could throw a clear and certain light on any dark and difficult passage of the Word of God. Stockbridge, December 1st, 1757. Reverend and dear sir, yesterday I received your 2 letters of the 12th and 17th of November, but I saw and heard nothing of Mr. Heal. I thank you for your concern that I may be useful in the world. I lately wrote you a letter informing you of our choice of a council to sit here on the 21st of this month, and enclosed in it a letter missive to Mr. Brimsmaid, who is one of the council. I hope before this time you have received it. Don't fail of letting me see you here, for I never wanted to see you more. As to the question you ask about Christ's argument in John 10:34-36, I observe first that it is not all princes of the earth who are called gods in the Old Testament, but only the princes of Israel who ruled over God's people. The princes who are called gods in Psalm 82 here referred to are in the same sentence distinguished from the princes of the nations of the world. I have said, ye are gods, but ye shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. Secondly, that the reason why these princes of Israel were called gods was that they, as the rulers and judges of God's Israel, were types and figures of him who is the true king of the Jews and the prince of God's people, who is to rule over the house of Jacob forever, the prince and savior of God's church or spiritual Israel, gathered from all nations of the earth, who is God indeed. The throne of Israel, or of God's people, properly belonged to Christ. He only was a proper heir to that throne, and therefore the princes of Israel are said to sit upon the throne of God, 1 Chronicles 29:23. And the kingdom of Israel under the kings of the house of David is called the kingdom of the Lord, 2 Chronicles 13:8. And because Christ took the throne as the anti-type of those kings, therefore he is said in Luke 1:32 to sit upon their throne. Thus the princes of Israel in the 82nd Psalm are called gods, and sons of God are all of them children of the Most High. P.S. December 5th, the opportunity for the conveyance of my letters to the ministers chosen to be of the council your way not being very good, I have sent other letters desiring you to take charge of conveying them with all possible care and speed. The gentleman invited to the council at his desire and that of his people met at Stockbridge January 4, 1758, and having heard the application of the agents of the college and their reasons in support of it, Mr. Edwards' own representation of the manor, and what his people had to say by way of objection against his removal, determined that it was his duty to accept of the invitation to the presidency of the college. When they published their judgment and advice to Mr. Edwards and his people, he appeared uncommonly moved and affected with it, and fell into tears on the occasion, which was very unusual for him in the presence of others, and soon after he said to the gentlemen who had given their advice that it was a matter of wonder to him that they could so easily, as they appeared to do, get over the objections he had made against his removal. But as he thought it his duty to be directed by their advice, he should now endeavor cheerfully to undertake it, believing he was in the way of his duty. Accordingly, having had by the application of the trustees of the college the consent of the commissioners of the society in London for propagating the gospel in New England and the parts adjacent to resign their mission, he girded up his loins and set off from Stockbridge for Princeton in January. He left his family at Stockbridge, not to be removed till the spring. He had two daughters at Princeton, Mrs. Burr and Lucy, his eldest daughter, that was unmarried. His arrival at Princeton was to the great satisfaction and joy of the college, and indeed all the greatest friends of the college, and to the interests of religion, very highly satisfied and pleased with the appointment. It was a singular fact that soon after his arrival at Princeton, he heard the melancholy tidings of the death of his father. It occurred on the 27th of January, 1758, in the 89th year of his age. The corporation met as soon as could be with convenience after his arrival at the college, when he was by them fixed in the president's chair. While at Princeton, before his sickness, he preached in the college hall Sabbath after Sabbath to the great acceptance of the hearers, but did nothing as president unless it was to give out some questions in divinity to the senior class, to be answered before him, each one have an opportunity to study and write what he thought proper upon them. When they came together to answer them, they found so much entertainment and profit by it, especially by the light and instruction Mr. Edwards communicated, and what he said upon the questions when they delivered what they had to say, that they spoke of it with the greatest satisfaction and wonder. During this time, Mr. Edwards seemed to enjoy an uncommon degree of the presence of God. He told his daughters he once had great exercise, concern, and fear relative to his engaging in that business, but since it now appeared, so far as he could see, that he was called of God to that place and work, he did cheerfully devote himself to it, leaving himself in the event with God to order what seemed to him good. The smallpox had now become very common in the country, and was then at Princeton and likely to spread. And as Mr. Edwards had never had it, and inoculation was in practice with great success in those parts, he proposed to be inoculated if the physician should advise to it, and the corporation would give their consent. Accordingly, by the advice of the physician and the consent of the corporation, he was inoculated February 13th. He had it favorably, and it was thought all danger was over, but a secondary fever set in, and by reason of a number of pustules in the throat, the obstruction was such that the medicine necessary to check the fever could not be administered. It therefore raged till it put an end to his life on the 22nd of March 1758, in the 55th year of his age. After he was sensible that he could not survive that sickness, a little before his death, he called his daughters to him, who attended him in his sickness, and addressed her in a few words, which were immediately taken down in writing, as near as could be recollected, and are as follows, quote, "Dear Lucy, it seems to me to be the will of God that I must shortly leave you. Therefore give my kindest love to my dear wife, and tell her that the uncommon union which has so long subsisted between us has been of such a nature as I trust is spiritual, and therefore will continue forever. And I hope she will be supported under so great a trial and submit cheerfully to the will of God. And as to my children, you are now like to be left fatherless, which I hope will be an inducement to you all to seek a father who will never fail you. And as to my funeral, I would have it to be like Mr. Burr's, and any additional sum of money that might be expected to be laid out that way, I would have disposed of to charitable uses." He said but very little in his sickness, but was an admirable instance of patience and resignation to the last. Just at the close of his life, as some persons who stood by, expecting he would breathe his last in a few minutes, were lamenting his death, not only as a great frown on the college, but as having a dark aspect on the interest of religion in general, to their surprise, not imagining that he heard or ever would speak another word, he said, "Trust in God, and you need not fear." These were his last words. What could have been more suitable to the occasion? and what need of more, and these are as a manner of instruction and support as if he had written a volume. This is the only consolation to his bereaved friends, deeply sensible as they were of the loss which they in the Church of Christ had sustained in his death. God is all-sufficient and still has the care of his church. He appeared to have the uninterrupted use of his reason to the last, and died with as much calmness and composure to all appearance as that with which one goes to sleep. The physician who inoculated and constantly attended him in his sickness addressed the following letter to Mrs. Edwards on this occasion. To Mrs. Sarah Edwards, Stockbridge, Princeton, March 22, 1758. Most dear and very worthy madam, I am heartily sorry for the occasion of writing to you by this express, but I know you have been informed by a line from your excellent, lovely, and pious husband that I was brought here to inoculate him and your dear daughter Esther and her children for the smallpox which was then spreading fast in Princeton, and that after the most deliberate and serious consultation with his nearest and most religious friends, he was accordingly inoculated with them the 23rd of last month. And although he had a smallpox favorably, yet having a number of them in the roof of his mouth and throat, he could not possibly swallow a sufficient quantity of drink to keep off a secondary fever, which has proved too strong for his feeble frame, and this afternoon between 2 and 3 o'clock it pleased God to let him sleep in that dear Lord Jesus whose kingdom and interest he has been faithfully and painfully serving all his life. And never did any mortal man more fully and clearly evidence the sincerity of all his professions by one continued universal calm, cheerful resignation, and patient submission to the divine will, though every stage of his disease, than he, not so much as one discontented expression, nor the least appearance of murmuring through the whole. And never did any person expire with more perfect freedom from pain, not so much as one distorted hair, but in the most proper sense of the words, he fell asleep. Death has certainly lost its sting as to him. Your daughter, Mrs. Burr, and her children, through the mercy of God, are safely over the disease, and she desires me to send her duty to you, the best of mothers. She has had the smallpox, the heaviest of all whom I have inoculated, and little Sally far the lightest. She is but 3 in her face, but I am sure it will prove serviceable to her future health. I conclude with my hearty prayer, dear madam, that you may be enabled to look to that God whose love and goodness you have experienced 1,000 times for direction and help under this most afflictive dispensation of his providence and under every other difficulty you may meet with here in order to your being more perfectly fitted for the joys of heaven hereafter. I am, dear madam, your most sympathizing and affectionate friend and very humble servant, William Shippen. This letter reached Mrs. Edwards while in a feeble state of health, when she was preparing to pay a visit first to her sister Mrs. Hopkins at West Springfield, and then to her mother Mrs. Edwards of Windsor in consequence of the death of Mr. Edwards' father. What her feelings were and those of her family under this unexpected and overwhelming dispensation can be more easily conceived than described. She had long told her intimate friends that she had, after long struggles and exercise, obtained by God's grace and habitual willingness to die herself or part with any of her most dear relatives, that she was willing to bring 4 children for death, and to resign up him whom she esteemed so great a blessing to her and her family, her nearest partner, to the stroke of death whenever God should see fit to take him. And when she had the greatest trial in the death of Mr. Edwards, she found the help and comfort of such a disposition. Her conduct on this occasion was such as to excite the admiration of her friends. It discovered that she was sensible of the great loss which she and her children had sustained in his death, and at the same time showed that she was quiet and resigned and had those invisible supports which enabled her to trust in God with quietness, hope, and humble joy. A few days afterwards she addressed the following letter to Mrs. Burr. Stockbridge, April 3rd, 1758. My very dear child, what shall I say? A holy and good God has covered us with a dark cloud. Oh, that we may kiss the rod and lay our hands on our mouths. The Lord has done it. He has made me adore his goodness, that we had him so long. But my God lives, and he has my heart. Oh, what a legacy my husband and your father has left us. We are all given to God, and there I am, and love to be, your very affectionate mother, Sarah Edwards. On the same sheet was the following letter from one of her daughters. My dear sister, my mother wrote this with a great deal of pain in her neck, which disabled her from writing any more. She thought you would be glad of these few lines from her own hand. Oh, sister, how many calls have we, one upon the back of another? Oh, I beg your prayers that we who are young in this family may be awakened and excited to call more earnestly on God, that he would be our father and friend forever. My father took leave of all his people and family as affectionately as if he knew he should not come again. On the Sabbath afternoon he preached from these words, "We have no continuing city, therefore let us seek one to come." The chapter that he read was Acts the 20th. Oh, how proper! What could he have done more? When he had got out of doors, he turned about. "I commit you to God," said he. "I doubt not but God will take a fatherly care of us if we do not forget him. I am your affectionate sister, Susanna Edwards." Stockbridge, April 3, 1758. Mrs. Burr and her children were inoculated at the same time that her father was, and had recovered when he died. But after she was perfectly recovered, to all appearance, she was suddenly seized with a violent disorder, which carried her off in a few days, and which the physician said he could call by no name but that of a messenger sent suddenly to call her out of the world. She died April 7th. 1758, 16 days after her father, in the 27th year of her age. She was married to Mr. Burr, June 29, 1752. They had two children, a son and a daughter. Mrs. Burr exceeded most of her sex in the beauty of her person as well as in her behavior and conversation. She discovered an unaffected natural freedom towards persons of all ranks with whom she conversed. Her genius was much more than common. She had a lively, sprightly imagination, a quick and penetrating discernment, and a good judgment. She possessed an uncommon degree of wit and vivacity, which yet was consistent with pleasantness and good nature, and she knew how to be facetious and sportive without trespassing on the bounds of decorum or a strict and serious religion. In short, she seemed formed to please, and especially to please, one of Mr. Burr's tastes and character, in whom he was exceedingly happy. But when crowned all her excellencies and was her chief glory was religion, she appeared to be the subject of divine impressions when 7 or 8 years old, and she made a public profession of religion when about 15. Her conversation until her death was exemplary as becometh godliness. She was in every respect an ornament to her sex, being equally distinguished for the suavity of her manners, her literary accomplishments, and her unfeigned regard to religion. Her religion did not cast a gloom over her mind, but made her cheerful and happy, and rendered the thought of death transporting. She left a number of manuscripts on interesting subjects, and it was hoped they would have been made public, but they are now lost. Mrs. Edwards did not long survive her husband. In September, she set out in good health on a journey to Philadelphia to take care of her two orphan grandchildren, which were now in that city and had been since the death of Mrs. Burr. As they had no relations in those parts, Mrs. Edwards proposed to take them into her own family. She arrived there by way of Princeton September 21st in good health, having a comfortable journey. But in a few days she was seized with a violent dysentery, which on the fifth day put an end to her life, October 2, 1758, in the 49th year of her age. She said not much in her sickness, being exercised most of the time with violent pain. On the morning of the day she died, she apprehended her death was near. When she expressed her entire resignation to God and her desire that he might be glorified in all things, and that she might be enabled to glorify him to the last, and continued in such a temper, calm and resigned till she died. Her remains were carried to Princeton and deposited with those of Mr. Edwards. Thus they, who were in their lives remarkably lovely and pleasant, in their death were not much divided. Here the father and mother, the son and daughter, were laid together in the grave within the space of a little more than a year, though a few months before their dwelling was more than 150 miles apart. Two presidents of the same college and their consorts, than whom it will doubtless be hard to find four persons more valuable and useful. By these repeated strokes, following in quick succession, the American church within a few months sustained a loss which probably in so short a space of time will never be equaled. Mr. and Mrs. Edwards lived together in a married state above 30 years, in which time they had 11 children, 3 sons and 8 daughters. The second daughter died February 14, 1748. The third daughter was Mrs. Burr. The youngest daughter, Elizabeth, died soon after her parents. concluding remarks, the writer of the preceding pages regrets, at least as sincerely as any of his readers, that the collection of facts which they contain is not more full and complete. Yet in consequence of the long interval which has elapsed since the death of President Edwards, they are all which, after much time and labor and travel, he has been able to discover. Such as they are, they constitute, with his writings, the body of materials from which we are to form our estimate of his character as an intelligent and moral being. In reviewing them, it is delightful to remember in the outset that so far as the human eye could judge, the individuals of both the families from which he derived his descent were, as far back as we can trace them, distinguished for their piety. Each married pair in both lines with that care and conscientiousness which so generally marked the pilgrims of New England, and their Puritan ancestors trained up their children in the fear of God and continued through life to supplicate daily the divine favor on them and their descendants in all succeeding generations. Their prayers, ascending separately and successively, indeed, were yet embodied in their influence, and from him who showeth mercy to thousands of generations of them that love him and keep his commandments, called down concentrated blessings on their common offspring. So full, so rich were these blessings as bestowed on the subject of this memoir, that perhaps no one example on record furnishes a stronger encouragement to parents to wrestle with God for the holiness and the salvation of their posterity. It was owing to the moral influence thus exerted and to the divine favor thus secured that when we review the childhood and youth of Mr. Edwards, we find them not only passing without a stain upon his memory, but marked by a purity and excellence rarely witnessed at so early a period of life. The religious impressions made upon his mind in childhood were certainly frequent, deep, and of long continuance, and had a powerful effect upon his ultimate character, yet the estimate formed of their real nature by different persons will probably be different. His own estimate of them was unquestionably that they were not the result of real religion. The circumstances which led him to this conclusion were these two. First, that after he had cherished a hope of his own conversion for a considerable period, and had experienced a high degree of joy in what he regarded as communion with God, he lost imperceptibly the spirituality of mind, relinquished for a season the constant performance of the practice of secret prayer, and cherished many affections of a worldly and sinful character. Secondly, that when he recovered from the state of declension, his views of divine truth, particularly those connected with the sovereignty of God, were in many respects new and far more clear and delightful than any which he had previously formed. Without calling into question the fact that a given individual has, on some accounts, decidedly superior advantages for judging of his own Christian character than others enjoy, and without presuming to decide on the correctness of the estimate thus formed by Mr. Edwards, it may not be improper to state various circumstances which lead me to suspect that it may perhaps have been erroneous. 1, the declension of which he complains appears to have been chiefly or wholly a declension in the state of the affections. 2, those impressions began when he was 7 or 8 years of age and were so powerful and lasting as to render religion the great object of attention for a number of years. As made on the mind of such a child, they were very remarkable, even if we suppose them to have resulted in piety. 3, the season of declension commenced soon after his admission to college when he was 12 years of age. Thus a truly pious child, in consequence of leaving his early religious connections and associations, and especially the altar and the incense of his parental sanctuary, of removing to a new place of residence, of entering on a new course of life, of forming new acquaintances and attachments, of feeling the strong attractions of study and the powerful incentives of ambition, and of being exposed to the new and untried temptations of a public seminary, should for a season so far decline from his previous spirituality as to lose all hope of his own conversion is so far from being a surprising event that in ordinary cases it is perhaps to be expected. Piety at its commencement in the mind is usually feeble, and especially is it so in the mind of a child. How often are similar declensions witnessed even at a later age? Yet the subject of such backsliding, though during its continuance he may well renounce the hope of his conversion, does not usually regard the period of his recovery as the commencement of his Christian life. 4, he had not at this period made a public profession of religion, and of course was not restrained from such declension by his own covenant, by communion with Christians, or by the consciousness that, as a visible Christian, his faults were subjected to the inspection and the censor of the surrounding world. Number five, though charitable in judging others, he was at least equally severe in judging himself. Number six, he appears at a very early period to have formed views of the purity of the Christian character, of the degree of freedom from sin, and of the degree of actual holiness requisite to justify the hope of conversion, altogether more elevated in their nature than the truth will warrant. Number seven, that his views of divine truth, particularly of the sovereignty of God, should have opened after the age of 12 with so much greater clearness and beauty as to appear wholly new, was to have been expected from the nature of the case. Number eight, at a subsequent period, when his mind was incessantly occupied with the unusual perplexities of his tutorship, he complained of a similar declension. Number nine, the purity, strength, and comprehensiveness of his piety, as exhibited immediately after his public profession of Christianity, was so much superior to what is frequently witnessed in Christians of an advanced standing, is almost to force upon us the conviction that it commenced not a few months before, at the time of his supposed conversion, but at a much earlier period of life. Rare indeed is the fact that holiness is not at its commencement in the soul as a grain of mustard seed, which is least of all seeds, and though in the rapidity of its growth it differs widely in different soils, yet time is indispensably necessary before its fruits can cover the full-grown plant like the clusters on the vine. These considerations, and particularly the last, have led me to believe that the early religious impressions of Mr. Edwards are to be regarded as having been the result of a gracious operation of the Spirit of God upon his heart. Under this happy influence exerted in childhood, his character was formed. It prompted him then to study the Scriptures, to love prayer, to sanctify the Sabbath, and to pay an unusual attention to the duties of religion. It inspired him with reverence towards God and made him afraid to sin. It rendered him conscientious in the performance of every relative duty, and manifesting love and gratitude, honor and obedience toward his parents, kindness and courteousness toward his sisters, and the other companions of his childhood, respect and deference to his superiors, and goodwill to all around him. It led him also at a very early period to overcome that aversion to mental labor which is so natural to man, and devote himself with exemplary assiduity to the great duty daily assigned him of storing his mind with useful knowledge. Some of our readers, we are aware, may perhaps regard the recollections of his earlier years as of little importance, but those who cherish common sympathies with the whole body of evangelical Christians, and a deep interest which they feel in his character and efforts, and who reflect that the foundation of that character and of those efforts was then laid, will require of us no apology for thus exhibiting the comparative innocence and purity, the docility and amiableness, the tenderness of conscience, the exemplary industry, and the ardent thirst for knowledge which characterized this vernal season of his life. The development of mental superiority in the childhood and youth of Mr. Edwards was certainly uncommon, if not singular. Boys of the age of 11 and 12, even when receiving every aid from their parents and instructors, and when feeling the influence of all the motives which they can present, are usually unwilling in any branch of natural science to examine so thoroughly to comprehend the discoveries and investigations of others. Still more unwilling are they to make this examination when no such aid is furnished and no such inducements are presented, but rare indeed is the instance in which the attention of such a boy has been so far arrested by any of the interesting phenomena in either of the kingdoms of nature that has been led, without prompting and without aid, to pursue a series of exact observations and discoveries as to the facts themselves, to search out their causes, and as a result of the whole to draw up and present a lucid, systematic, and well-digested report of his investigation. After the lapse of a little more than a year, just as he attained the age of 14, we find him entering on pursuits of a still higher character. Few boys of that age have sufficient strength of intellect to comprehend the essay on the human understanding. Of those who have, but a small proportion can be persuaded to read it, and a much smaller still are found to read it voluntarily and of choice. We find Edwards, however, at this period of life not only entering on this work of his own accord and with deep interest, but at once relinquishing every other pursuit that he may devote himself wholly to the philosophy of the mind, and to use his own language, enjoying a far higher pleasure in the perusal of his pages than the most greedy miser finds when gathering up handfuls of silver and gold from some newly discovered treasure. Nor is this all. While reading the work of Locke, he presents himself before us not as a pupil, nor simply as a critic, but in the higher character of an investigator exploring for himself the universe of minds and making new and interesting discoveries. Fortunately, his investigations are preserved and may be compared with the efforts of other distinguished men at the same period of life in other countries and in other ages. And if any one of all those efforts discovers greater perspicacity and mental energy than the notes on the mind, particularly the articles entitled Being, Space, Motion, Genus, the Will, and Excellency, we are yet to learn what is to be found and who was its author. The discussion of those very important and difficult questions in the last of these articles, what is the foundation of excellency in its most enlarged acceptation, in things material and spiritual, in things intellectual, imaginative, and moral, is not only original as to its youthful author and profound, but is even now, we believe, in various respects new to the investigations of philosophy. The notes on natural science furnish similar proofs of high mental superiority, and by their variety of topics, their general accuracy, and their originality evince a power and comprehension discovered by only here and there an individual when possessed of the full maturity of his faculties. His habits of thinking and reasoning at this time of life appear to have been as severe, as exact, and as successful as those of the most accomplished scholars usually are in the vigor of manhood. The plan of study itself, which he then formed, of studying with his pen, of immediately and of course employing the principle of the science he was examining, which has been already detailed and demonstrated by others in the discovery of new principles, is at least equal evidence of the same superiority. So vigorous was the mental soil that the seeds of thought could not be implanted therein without being quickened at once and made to grow into a rich and abundant harvest. Looking at these two series of notes in connection with the plan of study under which they grew, and when comparing them by the aid of recollection with the efforts of other children and use of uncommon promise, we instinctively ask, when and where has the individual lived who has left behind him substantial proofs that he is possessed at the same age a mind more powerful, comprehensive, or creative?